Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. The Jim Garrity not here today. Dan Foster of National Review Online is here to take his place. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Dan, we could talk about election night, but it's kind of a mixed bag. Not really horrible, not really good. So we're going to talk about a few other issues here, starting with Newt Gingrich's appearance on the Piers Morgan program on CNN. By us playing this clip, it'll probably double the audience that it got originally. But I think it still paints a pretty good portrait of how the media approaches politics and how thoughtful people approach politics. Piers Morgan, clearly all about the horse race here, assuming that Herman Cain is done, and he may be right about that, but he may not be right about that, saying that Newt Gingrich essentially wants to be the anti-Mitt once the real votes start, and Newt Gingrich is having none of that.
But the reality of politics is that you're probably going to be, whether you like it or not, perceived as the anti-Mitt candidate, aren't you?
See, this is something I find fascinating. Okay. I've been involved in politics since 1958. I helped grow the modern Republican Party of Georgia. I helped create a national majority. And you're explaining to me the reality of politics. The reality of politics is if you have a good enough leader who's positive enough, they can ignore the other candidates. They can create a positive majority around a positive set of solutions and let the other candidate worry about me.
Now, Newt's detractors will probably see that statement as a bit arrogant, and on some level it probably is. But it's also true that he's had a major impact on national politics over the last few decades, and the fact that ultimately people hopefully still respond to positive people with good ideas rather than the latest poll, which is apparently what Piers Morgan is most interested. So, Dan, I'm not sure that this means that Newt Gingrich is going to get as far as he wants to get, but it does mean that he is still the adult in the room, no matter which conversation he seems to be in.
Yeah, I think that kind of self-aggrandizement comes with the territory with Gingrich. And as I've said during the debates, he's shown himself time and again to be both the party's best PR man and its ombudsman or its provost. He's shown himself as kind of the conscience of the party, and he's been very, very good so long as what he's seen as doing is schooling the other candidates on some issue they're wrong about. And it hasn't just been one candidate he's picked on. I recall him getting applause on lines about pretty much everyone else in the field on one issue or the other. And you're right, he's a smart guy who has incredible recall, a very powerful institutional memory, a very powerful memory of great anecdotes, and can just marshal all this stuff in the service of adding to the debate. The interesting thing is, I don't know if that makes much of a difference once he does, in fact, become the guy who, you know, if he does become the next guy who's going to be the serious challenger to Mitt. And as much as it's a shame that the media is perpetuating this idea of there being Mitt versus the anti-Mitt, and there can be only one anti-Mitt, there's a bit of reality to it. And we can argue about whether that reality is constituted by the mainstream media or whether it's a real dynamic going on in the kind of collective psyche of Republican primary voters. I think the answer is it's a little bit of both. But the question for Mitt is, when the attention is on him, when he's not just there in the room to provide context or historical lessons or messaging lessons for mistakes that the other candidates are making, when it's about him, can his style and his past and his record stand up to that? And I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, he got off to such a horrible start in this race. There's obviously personal baggage that most Republican voters are well aware of, and if they're not, they certainly will be, should he ascend to be the chief non-Romney rival here. It's becoming a pretty small field that actually has a legitimate shot to win this thing, so I think it's right that he's getting more attention now that his poll numbers are doing better. I think most people realize that Ron Paul is pretty much where Ron Paul is going to get to. We still don't know what the impact of all this is going to be on Herman Cain, but if he does end up falling back, Newt Gingrich seems to be a guy who might stand to gain a few percentage points from that, in addition possibly to Romney if people see an inevitability there. Dan, on to number two now, and it just seems like yesterday, and almost was, that Jim and I were talking about Greece snatching chaos from the jaws of temporary stability with this EU bailout. Obviously, if Greece doesn't do the austerity measures and a whole lot more, they're just going to be back where they are in a few months from now, and they may never really get away from the default that they're headed towards. But now Italy on board, as A bunch of credit ratings have said that they are now borrowing and spending at a rate higher than is sustainable. Berlusconi has lost a vote of confidence. He's on his way out, assuming these austerity measures pass, which I guess is quite an assumption. Italy is a bigger economy than Greece, and if Italy starts going south in a major way, this is going to look like a huge row of dominoes that is eventually going to hit us very hard, and who knows where it stops.
I buy the kind of line from people I trust on this issue that Greece is really a sideshow. Italy is one of the major economies of Europe, which is why the fact that its political culture more closely resembles Greece's than it does Germany's is a problem, because they have the economy of an adult European power, but the political culture more or less of one of the kiddies. So this is a problem. And Berlusconi, we forget, as somebody pointed out to me, who would have ever thought it was budgets and not women that would have taken him out? You know, I think anyone who knows who has Italian relatives like I do knows that it's much more likely to be budgets than women that takes anybody down. But I wasn't really, you know, surprised by that as much. But it should be noted that despite Berlusconi's reputation for being a joker and having a lot of fun as prime minister, he also was seen as by greater Europe as somebody who would play ball, somebody who the rest of the European powers could trust in the context of European politics, an internationalist, somebody who kind of knew the way the game worked. And I don't know what's going to emerge, and I certainly don't know enough about the ins and outs of the Italian parliament to know what's going to emerge post Berlusconi, but him, there's a reason why he's going to stay on and oversee these austerity measures, because I don't think Europe, as Europe, trusts whoever his successor will be to do what needs to be done.
Italy has to be the backstop here, because you already have the French getting really, really nervous over the investments they have in Greece, for starters, but certainly Italy. And if France becomes a domino here, then the show is basically over. Because
Germany,
Germany can't bail out everybody. They can barely bail out Greece.
Right. They're talking about now the bailout fund needing a bailout. So, and I think that what we're really seeing here, and it doesn't go as far as Schadenfreude on my part, but I'm fascinated by what's happening in Greece and what's happening throughout Europe and this sort of crisis of the EU. If Europe was America, they would still be operating under the Articles of Confederation, right? And I think in the American context, and people forget, United States is the most successful monetary union in the history of the world. That's more or less how we started out. And I think that the succession of from the Articles to the Constitution, and obviously the parallel is not anywhere near perfect because there's 250 years and a bunch of cultural differences between the two. But the transition from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution was possible because the states, although they had their independent histories and certainly fiercely politically independent, they shared a culture, they shared cultural presumptions, and they shared a kind of project. I don't think the European project ever got to where the elites in that country think it did. And I think that the problems they had with the Lisbon Treaty and strengthening the EU, are indicative of all this. And I think they're learning right now that if you don't have one people, you can't have one policy.
That's definitely true. And we'll see how Berlusconi shepherds this through the parliament. But hopefully there's success there. We're going to have a whole lot more headaches than what we thought we had with Greece and everything else going on here. Dan, it's been a long 3 years of President Obama. We've had Obamacare foisted down our throat. The Democrats in Congress have resisted efforts led by Republicans to let us keep our beloved incandescent light bulbs. And more of our lives are being controlled by the government. But sometimes you just have to draw the line. Apparently the president doesn't know where to draw the line, though, because he is now imposing a new 15-cent charge on all fresh Christmas trees. It's the Christmas tree tax, and the best part is why this is supposed to be necessary. Apparently, the Department of Agriculture is going to appoint a special commission, and the goal is to include efforts to, quote, enhance the image of Christmas trees and the Christmas tree industry in the United States. Dan, I don't know of anything that's recession-proof, but I'm pretty sure Christmas trees are it. It's only a 15-cent tax, and most people are shelling out, what, $25-$30 at Lowe's or Home Depot, wherever they get their Christmas trees. But the idea that you would tax a Christmas tree with the idea that somehow people don't know about Christmas trees, this is just insanity at the nth degree.
When this news came out and Heritage first reported it,
right,
I heard from more than one person. Oh, Heritage is pulling a prank here. This can't possibly be true. But in fact, it's just – it's the perfect – and it's, you're right. It's a 15-cent tax, and people aren't necessarily really going to feel it. But it's the perfect distillation of this approach, which is essentially that we're going to tax an industry – and then use that money to help the industry, you know, right? And forget about the fact that this – I mean, that so that's just, I think, philosophically wrongheaded. But also it shows a certain kind of – it shows that – because don't get me wrong. I don't think President Obama had a cabinet meeting, a high-level meeting with all his national security principals where they talked about the wisdom of the Christmas tree tax. But that's almost more damning because it shows that just, you know, not only is the status quo of big government – to create more bodies and more – and incidentally, the fact that the Department of Agriculture has the power to do this under an act of Congress that's 15 years old, if you read the fine details, has the power to institute a tax without a separate vote in Congress is just – to me a symbol of and again, a minor one, but a real symbol of just the skew that's happened towards the executive and just the real kind of, you know, ignoring of the balance of powers that – that are the genius of the Constitution. We're just seeing, you know, that some board on some subcommittee of some bureau within an executive department in this massive federal leviathan can just turn into the Grinch, more or less literally, and do whatever they want on something like this. It's just a sign of what the status quo is in government. And the fact that they would do it and be so politically myopic as to do something like this you know, it's just an easy win for us on the right and just so easy to make fun of. It tells you really how uncommitted this administration is to fundamentally getting the government out of the American people's way. I mean, the president talks about unnecessary regulations and things like that, but this just seems like a no-brainer. Why do this? I mean, what's really gained the president's agenda with stupidity like this? It just shows that he's not really paying attention to the sorts of things that enrage people about federal bureaucracy.
I think you're right, but I think you also lurch to the possible silver lining here. The fact that an administration entirely focused on his political standing and certainly focused on next year just handed the Republicans a perfect issue. It's not going to really make a difference on national policy, but just the image you have out there of the president imposing a tax on Christmas trees just makes for political fodder like you can't believe. And hopefully whoever our nominee is makes the most of it, just as not the 15 cents, but just the mindset, like you mentioned, this administration has for more and more government, more and more intrusion into our lives. And Americans need to say we're fed up with it. But we'll find out how fed up they are in 12 months. So
yeah, it's an early Christmas present from President Obama.
Exactly.
To the right.
You said it. Dan, great to have you with us. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Likewise.
Dan Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Thursday for the next Three Martini Lunch.